The brain is an extraordinary organ. We've found out so much about it, yet there is still so much more to learn. Dr. Owen Jones is a research fellow in the Department of Psychology at the University of Otago. He's become an expert in memory, especially Alzheimer's, memory deficits and confusion, and the much rarer earlier onset frontotemporal dementia. Now, you may have heard about that condition recently. It is the one that actor Bruce Willis has been diagnosed with. It is progressive and aggressive. And Owen was recently awarded a Neurological Foundation project grant for a study into this dementia. Now, if you have any questions, text them through 2101 or email sundays@rnz.co.nz. But bore de kroeso. Good morning and welcome, Owen.
Good morning and welcome to you too.
A little Welsh greeting because, of course, you come from Wales. And, in fact, Welsh is your first language. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. My parents raised me speaking Welsh, didn't really speak English too much until I started going to school.
Wow, incredible. And we're going to speak more about being bilingual and learning more than one language a little bit later in this conversation. But sure. First, no treatment, no cure yet. There's no pressure, Owen. Tell us a little bit about your research in this area.
So I began my research in this area as a PhD student. I started a PhD working with Professor Cliff Abram, who is one of the biggest names, I suppose, in New Zealand neuroscience. He's been interested for several decades in plasticity mechanisms in the brain. So we know that nerve cells, neurons, have a tremendous ability to change their structure and change their function. So, for example, their connections, their synapses can become stronger or can become weaker. And it's through this changing of these connections that we're thought to store information, i.e. form memories, through this synaptic plasticity, as it's called. So it stands to reason that when you have diseases such as Alzheimer's disease, for example, that would affect memory so profoundly that these synaptic plasticity mechanisms, the ability of synapses to become stronger and to learn and store information, would become compromised. So I was very interested initially in the mechanisms that could regulate the strengthening of synapses. And so when I started my PhD, we started off with a model in which we found that glial cells, a certain type of support cell, sometimes they're called astrocytes, star-shaped cells, could release certain chemicals onto the local neurons in a given area, and that could, under some conditions, inhibit the ability of those neurons to then strengthen their connections. So the idea here would be that perhaps this process is being engaged somehow in certain disease states, and so this would perhaps contribute to the memory deficits or the learning deficits that we could see. So initially, we thought this might be of interest in models of Alzheimer's disease. And sure enough, we found that in one particular model of Alzheimer's disease, that this mechanism seemed to be aberrantly engaged. The astrocytes, these star-shaped cells, were releasing certain chemicals that were then stopping the local neurons from being able to wire up so well with one another. So that was my initial entry into the world of dementia research, along with other members of the lab, Cliff Abram and a PhD student at the time, now a research fellow called Anurag Singh. And in recent times, I've drifted away from Alzheimer's research and gone on, as you mentioned, to begin a project looking at mechanisms of frontotemporal dementia. So this is a far less well-recognized form of dementia. However, we found some very interesting things in a model of frontotemporal dementia. We have found that for some reason, and we're not sure why, but these plasticity mechanisms that I talked about seem to be aberrantly controlled very early in life, much earlier than the onset of the disease itself. They seem to be triggered by the by the aberrant activity of calcium channels. And so the project is basically looking at how these calcium channels are driving cells to become more excitable, how they are governing the ability of these synapses to become stronger, and perhaps what we can do to stop that process in the hope that this would then eventually lead to some kind of new therapeutic avenue.
Wow. Okay. Now, how common is this? Is this particular type of dementia, this frontotemporal dementia?
Well, frontotemporal dementia is not the most common form of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is far more common. However, if you were to look at people under the age of, say, 65, then actually frontotemporal dementia does become the most common form of dementia. It's a quite an aggressive early onset form of dementia, relatively speaking. But it's not one that we hear a lot about. It's not one that you see in the headlines. As you mentioned, though, Bruce Willis has recently been diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia, so we might assume that we would hear a little bit more about it going forward.
So through your research, what are you discovering that happens earlier in our lives that may, you know, may be contributing to dementia?
Well, in our hands, what we have found is that calcium channels, little channels in the cell wall and the cell membrane that open and allow calcium to flow into the cell, we have found that for some reason these calcium channels are a little bit hyperactive in a model of frontotemporal dementia. So what this means is that you get much more calcium flowing into the cell than you would otherwise get, and for some reason, this then triggers certain forms of plasticity. So usually in models of dementia, what you find is that the cells are less able to wire up well with one another. The synapses struggle to become stronger, and this might correlate then with learning and memory deficits. We found something quite different. In our hands, we found that very early on in life, much earlier than pathology becomes obvious, before neurodegeneration occurs, for example, we find that these calcium channels can trigger certain forms of plasticity. Under some conditions, they can actually make synapses much, much stronger. And under other conditions, when these calcium channels open, they can actually start making your brain cells fire much more readily. So all in all, it seems like these calcium channels are driving some kind of hyperexcitable state in the brain cells. And what we don't know is how that then contributes to the pathology that would emerge later on in life. So that's what we're hopeful of finding out.
Right. When I spoke to you the other day during when we were talking about this subject, you were talking about a lot of lifestyle things. And so we know about the having a good health, a good diet, and staying healthy and active is important. But there are other things that we can be doing to stop the progress of dementia and the loss of memory. What are they?
So the Lancet is a very big medical journal. So the Lancet's Commission on Dementia put out an updated list in 2020 of what they call modifiable factors. So these are factors that you could be modified in your day-to-day life that would alter your risk of developing dementia. So you're absolutely right that the big ones that we know about are getting regular exercise, for example, making sure that you have a diet that is high in fresh fruits and vegetables. So that the Mediterranean diet is one that's often put forward as being very good for protection against dementia. Social connectedness is the other one of the big three, as they're known. So remaining socially active, making sure that you're socializing with your friends on a regular basis, this has a very strong protective effect. But there are some other things that you can do. So in particular, you need to protect your senses. So we've just heard about the sense of smell. The other ones that we need to be aware of course, here, the big ones are hearing and vision. So we know, for example, that loss of hearing and loss of vision are both big risk factors for developing dementia. But the good news is that if, for example, you are diagnosed with hearing loss and then you start to use hearing aids, that risk diminishes. Likewise, if you have cataracts and your vision is therefore impaired, if you then go on to have surgery on those cataracts to repair them, then your vision is restored and your risk of dementia goes down again. So looking after your senses actually seems to protect the whole brain.
Right. Yes, because you often see, just the other day I drove past an audiologist. There was a sign outside saying even mild hearing loss is likely to cause dementia. What is it? Is it a physical thing, or is it like a lot of people who lose their hearing withdraw from society because it's very difficult? Anyone with hearing loss knows, you know, going into a crowd or it's very difficult to keep up. What is the connection there?
Well, it could be any of a number of things. So you're absolutely right. If you are hearing impaired or if you are visually impaired, then this might impact on your ability to socialize. And as I said, socialization, remaining social, that's a big modifiable factor that can govern the onset of dementia. So it could be that, or it could be that you're, for example, less likely to participate in regular exercise or to remain active. But the other option is that it could be something to do with inflammation. So I mentioned earlier the role of these astrocytes, these star-shaped cells that can release all sorts of things onto local neurons, nerve cells. So we know that under conditions of sensory deprivation, including, for example, things like loss of visual input, that astrocytes start to release certain inflammatory chemicals in the brain. And that some of these are actually very heavily implicated in Alzheimer's pathology. So it could be that hearing loss and loss of vision are triggering some amount of an inflammatory response in the brain. It could be that they are diminishing somebody's ability to participate in exercise or to remain socially connected, or it could be some combination of all of these things.
Right. Is there a way that we can build up a buffer?
There is, yes. So building up what's called cognitive reserve is known to be very, very beneficial in protecting against later Alzheimer's disease. So it all starts quite early in life. So the best thing that you could do is, for example, to remain in education as a younger person. There is a very strong link between your educational attainment in early life and your protection against Alzheimer's and other dementias later on in life, for example.
Okay. And things like, as I referred to earlier, if you can learn a second language, if you are bilingual or even multilingual.
Sure. So there is actually quite a good body of evidence that suggests that being bilingual is protective against Alzheimer's and other dementias. It's been correlated with better cognitive performance later on in life anyway, but it feeds into this idea of cognitive reserve. The idea being that if you are able to use two or perhaps more languages from an early age, then you're actually engaging a heck of a lot of your brain. If you think about what's required to learn language, it's not just auditory processing, listening and comprehending words. You could also learn to read that second language, and there's a lot of visual input there as well. You're using a lot of brain power. And so that's one good strategy for boosting your cognitive reserve. And that's been shown, as I said, to have a very strong protective effect against dementia later on in life.
Julie has just texted in saying, is there any connection to dyslexia?
I'm not sure. That's quite far outside of my area. I wouldn't really claim to know much about dyslexia. It's a very interesting question, and I'm probably going to end up looking at this immediately after we finish this interview. I'm sorry, Julie, I don't have the answer for you.
Right. And what about, we talk about learning languages and filling your brain with as much information, staying in school. What about, you know, taking up languages? What about later in life, you know, is it beneficial? Can you stop the decline at, say, at the age of 50, taking up a language?
Well, you can certainly do a lot in middle age, for example, to again buffer against the onset of dementia. Doesn't necessarily have to be learning a language, and the data on language learning does suggest that early bilingualism is more protective than later bilingualism.
Right.
That being said, going back to the Lancet Commission on Dementia that I mentioned earlier, they talk about the importance of cognitive reserve as a protective factor in mid to later life. So anything that would boost that cognitive reserve would, in all likelihood, be a good thing. So there's no reason to not take up a second language later in life. And, you know, we often hear about things like brain training or playing games to train your brain. The data on those modes of brain training aren't particularly convincing in terms of their protective benefits against something as severe as Alzheimer's disease. So perhaps trying to do something that's a little bit more engaging, for example, learning a language, taking up te reo, for example, that would contend would probably be more beneficial than just simply playing Sudoku or Wordle. No reason to stop playing Wordle. I play Wordle every day.
Yeah,
but it probably wouldn't be as good as something far more cognitively engaging, such as learning a second language.
Well, and Karen's asking, what about learning music?
So I would have thought that anything that boosts your cognitive reserve, in other words, any kind of highly involved learning, would have a beneficial effect, definitely. So it doesn't really matter if it's learning music, doesn't matter if it's learning languages, doesn't matter if it's somehow getting involved in some other discipline that you may not have studied previously. Anything would be good.
Right. Lifelong learners. It's what we should
exactly.
do. Yeah, yeah. But there's not necessarily a way to reverse the effects.
You can slow things down, and you can slow things down considerably. So as it happens, it's estimated that up to 40% of cases of dementia worldwide could be avoided through these modifiable factors that I've mentioned. So that's a staggering number.
Yeah.
That's a huge number. If we ever had a pill that you could take that had that kind of effect, you'd consider it the biggest win in the history of Alzheimer's research, surely. So these modifiable factors, they can have a huge, huge effect. So the idea would be to start early and try to protect yourself as best as possible. You can slow down the decline. You cannot, in all likelihood, reverse the decline. And we certainly don't have any viable treatment strategies for doing that as yet. So
okay.
prevention is better than a cure, as always, but it's doubly important when there is no cure.
Okay. There is one last question. We've only got about 30 seconds to go. The role that alcohol plays in dementia.
Yes. So alcohol is a risk factor. So on top of diet, on top of exercise, on top of staying socially connected, alcohol and smoking are both considered to be prime risk factors for the development of dementia. So avoiding both of those things is definitely a good idea.
Brilliant. Oh, wonderful speaking with you this morning, Owen. Thank you so much for your time and explaining a few things. We've got so many questions coming in, which we're obviously not going to get to, but it's they're all along the lines of, you know, staying healthy, cutting back on the alcohol, smoking, all of that sort of thing. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Owen.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Wonderful.